Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for May 10th, 2015. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta. Sorry I missed you last week.
Well, welcome back, too. That's really how I should have said it, from your trip to Savannah, I believe it was.
Yes.
Always good when we see other parts of, besides where we live, new perspectives. And even though you didn't miss the show, welcome back home too, Tim, because you were on the other way. You were up north of the mountains, Tim Shipley.
Yeah, and headed on over to South Carolina. Just forgive me if I spent a day in Trey Gowdy's district, okay? It was painful, but I made it.
That's right. Well, I tell you what, if you think point of the show, either one of y'all saw something a little different, mention that. Because sometimes when you see something that's not within, say, 50 miles of you, it gives you a little different perspective on things and than what you normally see day to day. And that's why we like to have all these guests on. And we're going to have a guest from up in Virginia, Lowell Feld from Blue Virginia, been on many times, going to come back again in about 20 minutes into the podcast and tell us about Virginia. But until then, we're going to take a American/Southern look at the British elections. And I know that sounds crazy, but Britain had their elections, and we can give you a quick synopsis because you can get a much better one somewhere else. But the Conservative Party won re-election, and a big reason they did is because the Scottish National Party went from like 6 seats to 56 seats at the expense of both the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrat. That's a very quick synopsis there. But I want to get to the Scottish National Party. This is a regional party, and most of the Scottish voters were more apt to support Labour. And they left.
You with us, David?
David?
Well, Catherine, I guess we'll go ahead and talk because we're... Oh. Are you with us, David? We're losing him,
yep.
Catherine, maybe.
Oh, it's
Tim,
he's coming back for a
clear
second, and then he goes away again.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, and I'll tell you what, my board's good, my phone looks good. Not sure, but keep me posted on if y'all can hear me or not. But I guess my synopsis was fading in and out, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, let's get to the question, and I'll skip that, and I hate this on the top of the show, but Scotland, they had the national voters that pulled away from Labour. And in America, could something like this happen? If it were to happen, where would it happen in the country? And I would postulate that the South might be primed to do this. And obviously, if a good chunk of Southern voters win anywhere, since so many Southern voters are Republican, it seems more likely that would hurt the Republicans than the Democrats, even though if something like this happened, say, 50, 60 years ago, it would have been the other way around. Tim, what do you think there?
Well, first of all, the Scottish voters must be schizophrenic or something. That, you know, they had a vote just last year on breaking away from Great Britain, declaring independence. The vote failed, barely, but it did fail. And now with 59 seats up for at stake, I think something like 58 of them were won by the Scottish National Party. And their main thing is advocating independence. So, I mean, what are they up to with that? As far as comparing it to this country, I don't know. Things, especially in modern times, have gone just a little bit differently. And I'll tell you why. Yes, there have been some strong third-party movements. And yes, they've had some effect on our presidential elections. But here it seems that these breakaway movements, or whatever you'd like to call them, had a charismatic individual at the head of it, like Ross Perot, Strom Thurmond, George Wallace. And once those people left the national stage, their movement seemed to evaporate with them, right?
Yes.
Is that Jim, David?
Yes. I'm here and I'm saying yes to you.
Oh, okay. But I see that as an essential difference right there. What do you think, Catherine?
Well, I might posit that it has already happened with the Tea Party.
Uh-huh.
That I think it would be difficult in this country to have an actual third party have any influence because ballot access is so difficult in most states the two party system is so strong in the United States that I think a lot would have to change. I think that it does sometimes happen on a local level. In my hometown, we did have a very strong third party for about a decade in the 70s that, you know, held city council and school board seats, but they ultimately were not able to maintain because ballot access was difficult to go beyond a local level. And so I think that's a problem. But I think that we've seen in certain parts of the country the Tea Party, the strength of the Tea Party, and if you looked at it that way, you could posit, like I said, that the Tea Party is almost like a third party.
Yeah. Tim, you mentioned something to me when we were kind of previewing this topic pre-show. Historically, the Dixiecrats were somewhat of this, and of course that failed, and it's not likely that the Dixiecrat movement will come back, will it?
No. Here's another thing you got to recall. The same thing that Strom Thurmond and the Dixiecrats did when they led a walk out of the Democratic Convention and broke away from the Democrats to run on their own in 1948, their idea was the same as that of the American Independent Party 20 years later with George Wallace. They had no realistic chance of winning because both were regional parties with civil rights as the chief issue. What they hoped to do was get enough electoral votes to throw the presidential election into the House of Representatives, and in that way they could both be power brokers in the choosing of the president. And it darn near worked. But man, going national, the closest thing I've seen is Ross Perot. He got 19% of the vote in 1992. A lot of people have said, you know, he cost Bush the election. I never believed that. But that's the closest thing I've seen to a national movement, David. I just don't know if what we just saw in Scotland would translate into something similar here.
Yeah, it's hard to see, and it's going to be interesting to watch what happens there too, because you've got the Liberal Democrats, which for years has been no worse than the number three party, and it's dissolving now. This regional party that only got 4.5% of the vote is now the number three party if you talk about number of seats, and so it's going to be something to watch. One more little note before we move off of the British elections, and it does have an American tilt to it, is
you know, the British parties, the conservatives, people say, oh, that's like the Republicans, and Labor, that's like the Democrats. Now, of course, both of those, you move them to the left. But Jim Messina, Barack Obama's campaign manager in 2012, worked for the conservatives. And then David Axelrod worked for Labor Party. You had two Obama, you know, campaign people doing this election on each side. No Republicans. Catherine, do you think this is kind of a sign that the Republican, you know, brand nationally has gotten so weak that they don't even want to mess with Republican consultants?
Huh.
Catherine?
I don't know. That's an interesting point. I think that what it indicates is that President Obama had some, you know, pardon my language, some kick-ass people working for him, and they were in demand.
Yeah. It's something to look at. Tim, I saw that article. I mean, how surprised were you to see that, you know, they really didn't even mess with any GOP consultants,
well,
even the Conservative Party?
You said it yourself. People want to say conservatives, well, that's the American version of Republicans. No, it's not. The conservatives and the Labour Party in England would be more akin to, I would say, moderate Democrats versus more liberal Democrats. And so these two Obama surrogates would fit in perfectly into that scheme. What really surprises me, though, is that they seem to put kind of an American brand on the election. This campaign was a little rougher than you normally see. It was more American style than we have seen in the past. For instance, there was just a scandalous picture of one of the major candidates, might have been Labour Party's candidate, eating a sandwich at a sidewalk cafe, and he was stuffing the sandwich into his mouth, and a photograph of him was snapped in a very unflattering pose and then was used in a campaign commercial by the other side. And that's just basically something you would not have seen an election or two back in England. But this is what the American operatives are very good at. I mean, it's sad to say that, but that, you know, you're going to see more of that in foreign elections, I think.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, because you would have to think just a few elections ago, you know, someone like Karl Rove would have been in demand.
Maybe in another country, not that one.
Yeah, or what was the McKinnon? Somebody like that. I mean, somebody that had been successful in, you know, American elections. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, they may want to win, and they're going to want the best. And in this case, they, you know, said, hey, one team wants one Obama guy, one team wants the other Obama guy. You know, kind of interesting to look at. Well, let's move on to another topic before we get in deep into Virginia. Let's go to Florida. Rick Scott, he's made a lot of news recently. He wants Medicare or Medicaid money, wants federal money for Florida, but he doesn't want it to be called Obamacare money. Catherine, what exactly is the difference?
Well, I don't know. I read the two articles that you sent, and I was totally confused by it. What difference does it make whether it's, you know, whether the check says from the Obamacare, like a check for, like the money's identified in any way anyway, right? I mean, it's not like federal money comes, oh, we don't want the money from that pot of money. We want it from this pot of money over here. It's ridiculous. I don't understand.
Yeah,
I was totally puzzled by the whole thing.
Yeah, I would think this, that a lot of times, you know, a politician may say, well, you know, I can't use Obamacare money because when I run for re-election, they're going to use it against me. But if it's my understanding, he's won run for re-election, he's won, he's, if you will, a lame duck The only reason that seems like it would be a factor would be that he wants to run again for another office. What do you think, Tim?
Well, you know, there's all kind of talk about him running for the Senate down there. But there apparently is something called the LIP funding, Low Income Pool, which is separate, although it's federal funding, it's separate from Medicaid. And it's available in time-allotted increments. And you have to meet certain qualifications as a state to get that money. And Florida didn't do this and then proceeded, and the feds kept telling them, you know, this is going to run out on such and such a date, and they seemed to proceed with their budget, including that funding, as if it was going to be there, and then it's not there. They cut it off as they said they would. Well, the problem there is that the legislature down there has absolutely stood up united with their governor and said no Medicaid expansion. So we're talking about several hundred thousand people just fell through the health care crack. Compounded by the fact that last year when he ran for re-election, he was all of a sudden moderating and saying, yeah, I'm all for Medicaid expansion. And then, of course, then right after the election, they forgot all about that. So he's between a rock and a hard place. And
yeah,
looks, what does he look to you? You know, incompetent. That's what he looks.
Yeah, looks weak. And this is a guy that was never popular throughout his term and won re-election just based on the year he ran. And any other year, he probably loses, but he gets lucky to get in office. He gets even luckier getting reelected after he's so unpopular. And now he's made this turmoil. This is a state in which health care is a major issue because a lot of times, even if this is not affecting people over 65, over 70, they worry more about medical care than any other age group. And if they think that you're not, you know, going to take care of medical care the right way, they're going to turn on you and with their population. So it's going to be interesting to watch. Well, let's go ahead at this time. We're glad to have from Virginia calling in again, Lowell Feld. Welcome, Lowell.
Hey, how's it going?
Good to have you on. Been blogging at Blue Virginia. We've been seeing some of the topics, so we want to discuss some of those. And it seems like the best place to start would be with the presidential race. The Democratic side's probably not as exciting as the Republican side because there's just not as many candidates. But let's go there since we're Democrats. How do things look, particularly with Jim Webb being in the race?
Yeah, it's interesting that Jim Webb is in the race, was, of course, U.S. Senator from Virginia. Latest polling by Christopher Newport University, just late April, did some polling here, showed Hillary Clinton with 80%, Jim Webb with 6%. So Jim Webb, who was a U.S. senator from Virginia, is at 6%, and you know, 74 points behind Hillary Clinton. So, as you said, the Democratic side is not as interesting, I guess, as the Republican side right now. Just if you're interested, Biden's at 5%, and Warren and Sanders are at 2% in that poll. So I think we could say Hillary Clinton is. And I think this is in state after state. She's pretty much dominant amongst the Democratic primary electorate, and we're definitely seeing that here. It's interesting because, remember, Barack Obama won that primary in 2008 in Virginia. It was an important primary, you know, start of a long streak for him in 2008 where he won, like, I forget, it was like 15 primaries in a row or something. And he won Virginia by, I forget, it was like 20, 30 points. He crushed Hillary Clinton in the Virginia primary, but clearly, Hillary Clinton is popular amongst Democrats in Virginia with 80% support. You know.
Just a follow-up before I pass it around to Catherine and Tim, why do you think Jim Webb's running for this, you know, the nomination when it's such an uphill climb?
Yeah, I mean, Jim Webb's an interesting guy. You know, of course, I've known him since I started getting to know him in late 2005, and then I co-founded this Draft James Webb movement, and then worked for the Jim Webb for Senate campaign in 2006. So, I mean, I've known the guy pretty well. I mean, I haven't been in touch with him that much the last few years, but he's a very stubborn guy. I mean, he definitely is very strong-minded. We'll say that. I mean, he's got a lot of ideas. I think that's part of it. I really do. I mean, it sounds like a kind of BS thing that politicians say, like, I want to get my ideas out there. But I actually think he does. He's a writer, basically, more than in a lot of ways, more than he's a politician. He's a thinker and a writer. And I think he's got ideas about economic populism. He's got ideas about foreign policy, certainly. And so I think there's that. And then certainly to run for public office in general, I think you have to have an ego. And to run for U.S. Senate, you really have to have an ego. And to run for president, you really, really have to have an ego. So he's got an ego. And, you know, he probably thinks there's a chance somehow. Maybe Hillary stumbles. And, well, same thing, by the way, with Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders. You know, what are they thinking? So, but we'll see if Jim Webb actually runs. Right now it's an exploratory committee, and he's been to Iowa a few times. He's been to New Hampshire. I think he might have been to South Carolina. And but, you know, we'll see if he actually runs. I don't think he wants to be vice president. Let's just get that out of the way. He could have been, I think. There was a chance, possibly, in 2008. My understanding is that the Obama campaign was potentially interested in him, but he didn't want to be vetted to go through the process to even be considered as a running mate. That's my understanding. So, and I believe that, knowing Webb. So, and I don't think he's running to be like to get a cabinet position or anything like that. I don't think that's what motivates him. So, but yeah, right now it doesn't seem like he's gaining any traction. In fact, just recently I was at a straw poll event in Arlington, Virginia, which is where Jim Webb's headquarters was in 2006, and where a lot of his support was very, very strong. And there was a straw poll for president, and he got like 1 or 2% in Arlington. Like, so yeah, so it's not seeing him catching fire right now here.
Yeah. Well, I'll go ahead. Like I said, I want to go ahead and pass it on to Catherine and then Tim for other questions about the presidential race. And, of course, Catherine, you don't have to stay on the Democratic side of things. Catherine? Catherine, you there with us? Let me check the board real quick. Tim, Catherine, I think went on hold. I'm going to take her off there. Catherine, you probably hear me, but we can hear you if you got questions on the presidential
race. Can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Oh, okay. Thanks for being on, Will. We always like to hear from Virginia.
Cool.
So it sounds like they're not – so is there a lot of support for Hillary, I guess, is the question. I mean, you said that she got, what, 80% of the straw poll. But is there a
No, that's of the that's a real poll, actually. The Christopher Newport University poll has her at 80% in Virginia.
Oh, okay. So, but is there a lot of lively support? Like, is there like a lot of, you know, like there's a lot of lively support here in Georgia for her. You know, there's
mm-hmm.
been these ready for Hillary things going on for like a year. And
yeah.
is it like that there also?
I mean, there is. I'm not as plugged right now. My focus, honestly, is on Virginia this year. We'll get to this a little later, I'm sure. But the entire General Assembly is up for election, and in fact, I've made this point to a couple of the Clinton people that, you know, I have nothing against. Obviously, they need to organize and do their thing, but I hope they'll try to help, and I think they're intending to help in Virginia this year. You know, Hillary Clinton's campaign has said, in fact, she said it, that they're going to be organizing in 50 states, and that that's my understanding is that's what they're really going to be doing. So we'll see. But yeah, they're ready for Hillary events, and I know I've seen them. I see them on Facebook, and this guy Adam Parkamenko, who's one of the top people in the Hillary Clinton campaign, has been with her since he was like 16 years old. I think he started trying to draft her when he was like 16. Now he's like 26 or something. But he's from Arlington, Virginia, and, you know, so, yeah, no, there's definitely support here. But, I mean, like I said earlier, I mean, Barack Obama won the Virginia Democratic primary in 2008 over Hillary by, I forget, it was like 20 or 30 points. It was not even close. He crushed Hillary Clinton in that. So, it might have just been, that was a phenomenon that year for Obama, no doubt. Might not indicate that she's unpopular, like that, as much as he was just wildly popular.
I see. Well, that's kind of what I was getting to was, is this less of a comment on Jim Webb and more on just the popularity of Hillary Clinton?
Well, I would say that, except that for one thing, when you look at the second choices, when the pollsters ask who is your second choice, like, you don't see Jim Webb doing very well there either. So,
like him as their senator.
He was always, it seemed like, around in the upper 40s approval rating, or maybe close to 50. He never was like super popular. He was never super unpopular in Virginia. He just was sort of, and he didn't run for re-election, obviously, for U.S. Senate. Not because I don't think that was because he thought he was going to lose or anything. It was for other reasons. But he was okay. He was moderately popular and wasn't wildly either direction. Wildly popular or wildly unpopular. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I wasn't trying to interrupt you.
No, I just don't think, it doesn't seem like there's any, I don't think Webb has grabbed the imagination. If you look at poll after poll, state after state, I'm pretty sure it would be the case in Georgia as well. He's just not, he hasn't grabbed the imagination for whatever reason of Democratic Democratic primary voters. It seems like it's either Clinton and then maybe Elizabeth Warren, but even she's far behind Hillary Clinton. But if anything, it would be someone like that. And Biden hasn't either, by the way. And Sanders has. I saw a New Hampshire poll. I think Sanders was in the 20s or something, and Hillary was like 60 or whatever. That he's from Vermont, which is right next door to New Hampshire. So, I think Hillary is the definite strong favorite for this nomination. Of course, we said that in 2007, right?
I think you hit on something that I think is really important for, those of us who are, good, strong Democrats to remember, is that it's important to have, something can always happen, whether it's, mm-hmm. External or internal happenings, whether something happens, God forbid anything should happen to her health-wise, or something comes out, whatever it might be, that scars her campaign in such a way that she can't really, there's no hope that she could win. I don't expect that to happen, but it's important to sort of be prepared for that and have someone that is prepared and that people know about to step in. It's almost like a safety net. And right now we really don't have that person. I don't think Bernie Sanders is that person.
Yeah. Well, I also think primaries, my experience over the years watching Democratic primaries, being involved with them, is that they generally make the candidates stronger.
I also agree with that.
Yeah, and they shake out some of the issues, whatever the issues are. I'm not talking about like their positions on the issues. I'm talking about if the candidate has issues, like if they have some skeletons in their closet or whatever. Those usually come out, which better to come out in the primary than in the general election, right?
But I also do think that they bring issues to the forefront that might not
mm-hmm.
be discussed. I think that if we go back to like 2004, I think as crazy as Dennis Kucinich is and Howard Dean, I think they brought things into the discussion of that during that election that made it more interesting and made more and engaged more people. And I think the same was true in 2008 with President Obama and Hillary Clinton and the rest of them. And I think the Republicans could say,
this clown car business has to stop. It's ridiculous. What are there going to be, like, 20 people running for Republican? But I do think that it mixes up the issues, because if you only have one person running, then the things that they don't want to talk about don't get talked about. Whereas if you have at least two or three people, then it sort of mixes up the topics and brings things to the forefront and sort of challenges them to formulate platforms around issues that they might not really have done if there hadn't been a primary.
Right.
I think we saw that in Georgia in the Senate primary, mm-hmm. on both sides. So I think it's good.
And it can bring ideological diversity as well, which can be good. But it can be bad in the sense that, like, look at the Republic. Let's talk about the Republicans for a second here. You know, I mean, look what happened to them in 2012. You had these far right, further right, even further right people running, and they dragged the general consensus, which I often don't agree with, but in this case I sort of do, is that it forced Romney too far to the right, like, and it forced him into, or maybe he believed it anyway, I don't know what he believes, but, you know, into making comments like self-deportation and other things that were, you know, in the general election would be detrimental, would be handicaps for the person, for him, for the nominee. So those debates were like, I remember watching those Republican debates and just loving it as a Democrat, because I'm like, this is material.
Oh, yeah.
We can use this material. This is great. Like, whichever one of these clowns gets the nomination, they've said stuff that did ads write themselves, you know. So that, in that sense, it can be bad. But I don't think we have that. Like, I don't think – even Bernie Sanders, who's a quote-unquote socialist, whatever, democratic socialist, he doesn't – if you listen to the guy, I mean, his positions aren't particularly out there as far as I can tell.
Oh, no,
I mean,
he's not wacky. He's just – he's more you know, he's what I would call a traditional liberal, really.
Yeah.
I mean, he can call himself a socialist, and everybody calls him socialist, but when you hear him talk, he sounds like a 60s liberal, really. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, he and a lot of what he talks about are, and he's a good example. I think he talks about a lot of things like income inequality and minimum wage, things that, given the opportunity, Hillary Clinton probably wouldn't want to delve too deeply into. I don't think she wouldn't want to talk about them, and I'm not trying to criticize her about this, but I just don't think they're the issues that are front and center for her campaign.
Right, and for Sanders, things like expanding Social Security, things like, it would be interesting to hear a debate on trade. We have
mm-hmm.
this big
yeah.
debate going on now on Trade Promotion Authority and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That will be interesting to see how that – of course, that's a tough one for Hillary Clinton. You know, Barack Obama's been fighting with Elizabeth Warren on that one. That's kind of interesting. But, you know, you need to have these debates within a party. There are differences.
Absolutely.
Right. Just in, on the Republicans –
Tim, I didn't mean to hog the time.
Oh, that's great. I'm enjoying listening to it. It's very interesting.
Yeah,
go ahead and finish your thought, please.
No, I was just going to say, because you had asked earlier what the Republicans were in Virginia, how they were looking. So that's a much, you know, whereas the Democrats, Hillary Clinton is dominant. In that same poll that was done on April 27th, it showed a total mess, basically. Bush was at 17. I mean, remember, Hillary was at 80. Amongst the Democrats. Amongst the Republicans, Bush is at a whopping 17. Wow. Then Marco Rubio, 16. So, I mean, then Walker, 10. Christie, 10. Paul, 10. Carson, 7. Cruz, 7. Huckabee, 6. Jindal, 2. Fiorina, 1. You know, like, it's, so, I mean, clearly that one's up for grabs. And I think, again, that's in state after state. I mean, there's no clear front runner on the Republican side in Virginia. And probably not anywhere else, really. I don't know about Georgia, but, you know, Jeb Bush, by the way, was just in Virginia on Saturday speaking to a gazillion, this is kind of scary, but graduates at the Liberty University commencement. That's Jerry Falwell's, you know, school, and pandering basically, or you could say whatever, I mean, appeal, trying to appeal to, you know, fundamentalist evangelical voters, whatever. You know, he threw out some red meat to those people at that commencement address on Saturday, so it's kind of interesting. Big school, though. It's a big school in Virginia, and also they have a huge online presence. It's a huge school, Liberty. It's all across the country online. So anyway, yeah, so that's what I wanted to say. I didn't mean to interrupt you guys.
Oh, that's quite all right, because you answered like my first two questions right there. So,
there you go. So I'm glad I accomplished something here.
Yeah, the next thing I want to go to, though, is a name we haven't heard in a while, and that's the name of Mark Warner.
Mm-hmm.
Story after story after story after story in the last couple of years. Short list
mm-hmm.
for Hillary's VP. What's the scoop?
The interesting, because the one that I've been hearing a lot more about here amongst my sources and everything here in Virginia, amongst the chatter amongst insiders, Democratic insiders, is Tim Kaine is the... definitely Tim Kaine. And also I've been hearing for a long time that Kaine really wants to be vice president, basically, would like to be her running mate. Warner, you know, he wanted to be president. He started running for president back in 2007, I guess it was, and then he just quickly, he was gearing up, and then he just pulled the plug. No one really, to this day, I've never heard a coherent explanation as to why he did that, but clearly he has aspirations. I mean, what do they joke about the Senate? Every senator looks in the mirror every morning and sees a president, right? So, you know, they're all like that. But I've heard Kaine, though, you know, I think Kaine would bring to that, for Hillary, first of all, Virginia, of course, which is, I don't think there's a way for Republicans, I mean, maybe theoretically there is, but to win the White House without Virginia, that would be really hard. So he
mm-hmm.
certainly is an asset in Virginia. He also is Roman Catholic, so that's, you know, obviously important. And then he is he actually was born in Missouri, so he still has some of those little ties there. But he also speaks Spanish. This is more even important, much more important than the Missouri thing. He speaks Spanish fluently. He was a Catholic missionary in Honduras as a young man, and so he's got an interesting, and he speaks Spanish very, very well. He gives interviews in Spanish fluently. So I think Kaine brings a lot more potentially to her ticket. Kaine was on the short list for Obama in 2008,
mm-hmm.
and Warner was not on the short list, from my understanding, in 2008 for Obama. So I think that Hillary would be looking at someone more like Kaine. Warner also, I mean, he's sort of seen to be from the more moderate corporate wing of the party. I'm not sure if that's what she needs. I mean,
mm-hmm.
she might need, not that Kaine is a leftist in any way,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
I don't know if Warner gives her much of anything that, like, Kaine, I think whatever Warner can give her, Kaine can give her and more, in terms of the Spanish, in terms of the Catholic, in terms of the, you know, his story, his bio, his roots. And, you know, Kaine has developed a lot of foreign policy expertise himself. Now he's on the Foreign Policy Committee. He's an interesting guy. He's, you know, taken some stances. Not that he's against necessarily intervention in all cases, but he's been very tough about that Congress needs to have a role to play in whether it's Iran or whether it's ISIS. Or ISIL, or whatever you call them, in the Middle East. You know, he's an interesting potential pick for her coming out of Virginia, if that's the direction she, you know, decides to go. I think
mm-hmm.
Warner, I'm sure I would think he would accept if he were asked.
mm-hmm.
But I don't think Warner loves the Senate, you know. I mean...
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, I'm not sure why he'd love being vice president then. You know, he's an executive at heart. He was a business guy. He was governor. He loved being governor. You know, why would you want to be, vice president? what did they used to say about that office? It's like not worth anything more than a bucket of warm spit or whatever.
Yeah, they didn't use the word spit originally, but I understand.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. Good
now,
point.
A lot of my listeners from other states don't really know the lay of the land in Virginia and where the strong pockets of this and that vote are located. So I want to give you a little scenario. Let's say on primary night, Republican primary night next March.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you're in the Jeb Bush campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you looking for your strong voters to come out in that state so that you can win that primary if you're, say, an establishment candidate?
I mean, I would think that establishment candidate would be more of in Northern Virginia. Maybe it depends what wing of the establishment, but I feel like, you know, more evangelical voters are more in the rural areas, so maybe that would be mm-hmm. more of the Huckabee type voters or the more, and I mean, Bush is, again, I just mentioned he was at Liberty University, so he's trying to appeal to those voters, but I would
uh-huh.
think Bush would do better in places like Fairfax County, Arlington County, Alexandria, maybe down in the Hampton Roads area. That's a mm-hmm. very heavy military area, major naval base down in mm-hmm. Hampton Roads. I mean, if people are more concerned about foreign policy and, you know, they don't want necessarily like a Rand Paul who's maybe seen as more isolationist, maybe wouldn't raise the defense budget. Virginia relies heavily in that area, particularly, and Northern Virginia too. We have the Pentagon in Arlington, Virginia. We have a lot of the military defense contractors inside the Beltway and outside the Beltway that goes around the D.C., you know, Washington, D.C. And so I would think Bush, that's where he would be looking for his money. Of course, there's tons of money there. And also his a lot of his support, I would think, unless he manages to broaden to more rural and evangelical type voters. It's possible, but with 20 candidates, I don't know.
yeah, really.
We'll see. Virginia's one of the earliest, by the way. This year, I guess it's going to go, let's see, Iowa, New Hampshire, then what, Nevada, I think, South Carolina, and then I think it's this Super Tuesday, basically, March 1st, and Virginia's part of it, I believe, unless the Republicans change it.
Okay.
It will be one of the earlier, unless Florida sneaks in there. I can't remember if Florida sneaks in there earlier, but on the Republican side. But it's an early one. And so so there still could be a lot of candidates in the race. Don't know how many it would have been weeded out by then. So, yeah. I would think, you know, a Huckabee type would be looking for support more in the rural, you know, areas of Southwest Virginia, maybe Western Virginia, Southern Virginia, a lot of evangelicals. It's hard. I mean, I don't, you know, we'll see who's in the field. I mean, you know, I think Chris Christie would have the same as Bush type of areas
uh-huh.
of the state,
right,
where he would be going for. Maybe Rubio, I guess, I don't know. I mean, I have to see how these people define their campaigns and flesh them out and what they emphasize. But Rand Paul, I would think, he would have some support in the Northern Virginia area, too. And this is where the population in Virginia is heavily concentrated, is in Northern Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And then, to a lesser extent, Hampton Roads and Richmond is called the urban-suburban crescent in Virginia. That's a huge swath of the population of Virginia. It's, you know, down the 95, down I-95 and down, yeah. So that's what it would probably, something like that.
All right. I appreciate it then. David?
Yes. Well, now we're going to go from presidential way down to really, really local with the House of Delegates. And Lowell,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's just my perception or if it's reality, but it seems like y'all have more special elections in Virginia. If not more special elections, you have more competitive special elections than the average southern state. And it looks like you've got another one House of Delegates 45, I believe it is, and you got a candidate on each side, and people are running hard. Give us the breakdown of that.
Yeah, that's a kind of a entertaining one in a way, just because of why there was a vacancy there. The incumbent, Rob Krupicka, he's just elected in September 2012 in another special election. the guy who had been delegate there resigned, basically because his marriage was falling apart because he had a bunch of affairs, and his wife had left him, and it's a nightmare. I shouldn't even laugh, but it's just the whole thing was like a farce. This guy Rob Krupicka became delegate, and he's been there two and a half years, and he just decided that he wanted to go into business and open up a donut shop. Okay. So it turns out that running a donut shop apparently takes a lot of time. Who knew that? I mean, you could have grease fires. Who knows? And apparently when you own the donut shop, you don't just necessarily want to have a manager doing it, and you're hundreds of miles away, or you're down in Richmond doing your thing and the place is on fire from the grease or whatever. So you want to actually be there. That's part of the reason, apparently. He was finding that he really couldn't do both, it sounds like, and he decided he wanted to focus on his business. And in all seriousness though, I do think this reflects to some extent on one thing is what we pay these people, these citizen legislators, quote unquote, which is basically nothing, $17,000-$18,000 a year, which it's supposed to be a couple months of your year, but it's way more than that. And then if you're a Democrat in Virginia and you're in the House of Delegates, there is a 100-member House of Delegates, and there are only 32 Democrats in the House of Delegates out of 100. So we're powerless. So if you're a Democrat, you're like, okay, I make no money. I get to sit in traffic on 95, driving down to Richmond in the middle of the winter. I get to have no power and not get any bills passed and not do anything. And this is great, or I can run a donut shop. Which would you do? I mean, I think Rob Krupicka has made the smart choice there. But anyway, so he's stepping down. So now there's a five-way race. See, there are still people who want to do that. There are five people running to succeed Rob Krupicka and let him run his donut shop. And I honestly cannot tell you which one of them is going to win, because I think certainly four of them could. Any one of four of them possibly could. This, by the way, this district is in mostly Alexandria, Virginia, which is right next to Arlington, a little bit of South Arlington. So there are going to be a couple of debates coming up, and we'll see how those go. Rob Krupicka endorsed one of the candidates. There's one woman and four men running, so we'll see if that plays a role. And actually, the current delegate who's leaving to run the donut shop, he's providing free donuts for everyone running. But also he endorsed one of the woman, actually, Julie Jakopik, who's one of the candidates. So we'll see if being a woman, having the endorsement of the donut guy and the incumbent delegate, if that's enough for her. But there are several other strong potentially strong candidates there. So that primary is on June, 9th, I think it is, the 9th. So coming up in just 4 weeks, actually.
So there's a primary and then an election?
Well, that's the primary for the Democratic nominee. And this is an overwhelmingly Democratic district. This is most districts, of course, the way that everything is gerrymandered, most districts are safe Democratic or safe Republican. And so this is the thing. Voters, it's maddening to me, watching this. Voters don't get it. They don't understand. The primary is way more important than the general election in probably 90%+ of these elections, at least. Because whoever wins the primary in a safe blue or safe red district is overwhelmingly likely to be the next delegate or senator or whatever. And yet the turnout for these primaries would be minuscule. I mean, some of these primary turnouts
And then everybody complains that there's nobody running.
Yeah, I mean, right? And there are good people running. I mean,
because we have the same situation here in Georgia.
Right, it's everywhere. The primaries
are where the, you know, candidates are selected in almost, in most of the races. And people don't vote. And then they complain, well, you know, nobody's running against so-and-so. Or no, and it's like, well, that's because it's a safe district. There's why are Democrats going to pour money into something that isn't, there's no way they can win? And why are Republicans going to do the same thing? Like, you know, I don't know.
They won't.
But you're absolutely right. Voters don't get it.
So the primary is it. I mean, the same thing, by the way, for Congress last year, we had a Democratic primary to nominate someone to run for a vacant. Jim Moran stepped down, resigned after many years, retired, whatever. And again, the turnout was very, very, very low. And yet, that's again was in an overwhelmingly Democratic congressional district. That's going to be your next Congress. Whoever Democrats nominate is like 99% at least likely to be the next congressman. So you'd think. So that should be the election you vote in. Definitely, like the general election, yeah, fine, vote. I mean, I always vote, but like that's not nearly as important as the primary. But most people think it's the opposite. And I don't get it. Like, I don't know what the disconnect is there, but for there is one. I mean, because as you said, it happens in Georgia, it happens everywhere. And I don't really get it. But so this turnout, and this will be low, as usual. And that's kind of sad. I mean, the other thing is, of course, you don't have to get 50% of the vote to win this primary. In fact, in Virginia, they don't allow you to have instant runoff voting. Instant runoff voting, you can pick your first choice, your second choice, your third choice, your fourth choice, whatever. And then the way it works is the lowest one in each round drops off, and those votes get reallocated. So, but the winner has to have 50% plus one. So it guarantees
I'm going to ask y'all a question, all of y'all a question, not just Lowell. Instant runoff voting. We've talked about it and talked about it. We talk about it saves money. Is it in action anywhere? To me, it sounds like the unicorn. It's an idea, but you never actually see it in practice. Is there somewhere in the United States, you know, that they're practicing this? On any, you know, large scale?
Yes. Well, not
where
we've done it. We've done it in Arlington.
In Oregon?
Oregon? Yeah, we've done it in Arlington for caucuses. You can do it for party-run caucuses, and we have.
Party.
And
they
can't do it because Virginia law says you can't, for a state-run primary. But, yeah, we have done it several times here, and it's worked well. Yeah.
David, I think it's either Oregon – or somewhere in California has done it. My hometown, we did it for city elections in the 70s. We were the first place in the country to do it, but it didn't last. Didn't last.
Yeah. And
but that's
to me,
it's not like
it's going to be a Democratic advantage or a Republican advantage. It's just going to be a money saver because then you have to have, you know, runoff elections. Well, and Catherine, that, since you kind of stepped up, that's good. I know you love party topics, if you will, and we have one that Lowell posted about on Blue Virginia, if you want to go ahead and ask about that.
So, Lowell, you're executive director of the Democratic Party?
Mm-hmm.
Is the one who came from North Carolina?
He had been... apparently fired from that job. Now, I'm not saying this is bad about him or anything. I mean, this is politics. Anything could happen. Who knows? But he resigned officially the other day after about a year on the job here. And I heard from sources that he actually was told to resign. So, you know, the thing is that people bring in their teams. So, I mean, I don't know. I've heard mixed stories on him. Some people say he was okay. Some people said he didn't do a good job. But the guy's name is Robert Dempsey.
So
he
was probably adequate then, right?
I don't know.
When you hear that, you're like, okay, some people hated him. Some people liked him. He was probably making some tough decisions. He was probably doing okay, but, you know, the politics.
It's really hard to say because the thing is there's so many systemic problems with these state parties, and Virginia is certainly one of those, that – you know, it's hard to say. If you're given, like, let's just say you were hired to manage a baseball team. Let's just say the Atlanta Braves or whatever. And let's say they were decimated. Let's say they had no pitching, no hitting, no money, no fans. No, and you're like, okay, run this team. And how will you, you know, and then after like a year, of course, you only, maybe you went 40 and 122 or whatever, and you're fired. Like, but of course you did, because you had the minor league system was gutted, everything was like, well, that's kind of like how I feel like the state park. I'm not trying to make excuses for this guy particularly. I don't really care about this individual. I don't barely know the guy. But I think there's systemic issues with these parties. I mean, they don't have any independent sources of money. They're always broke. They have this constant turnover. New governor comes in, then he puts his own people there. You know, nobody seems to have an interest in building up these parties. In fact, they seem to have an interest in keeping them weak because they don't want a rival power center or whatever. You know, it's so, yeah, I mean, it's, to me, it's frustrating. I think we should have a strong party because I think the job should be to build the Democratic bench, to build the farm team, to keep with the sports metaphor here. And that's a permanent thing. That should never stop.
It's a movement. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. What I see in party politics is that they're constantly in a campaign mode when they should be in movement mode, right? They should be building, like, they should be looking at, like, 2020 and 2024,
and
building towards that while the candidates are running their campaigns over top of whatever movement and support can be built, like, infrastructure can be built by the party. The problem is that, you know, it takes money. It takes a lot of money. And,
well, you know, it doesn't have to take – yeah, it takes some money, but I think you can do it with a grassroots model where you really delegate and you try to strengthen your local committees as much as possible in your cities and counties, and you go around and do trainings. And it doesn't have to be super expensive. I mean, it does take some money and some resources, but – and you can use technology, the internet-based and other technologies to leverage – you know, you don't have to have a huge staff. I don't think at this point. I just feel like these parties are not – they haven't innovated, you know, with the technology. They haven't kept up with the advances we've seen in various communications technologies and other things. So it's just – I don't know. This, you know, you mentioned this guy resigning, and, I mean, perhaps you were looking for, like, the juicy story more. But to me, it sets me off on this whole issue of this party – the weakness of the parties and the fact that we need somebody to be permanently – building the party at the local and state levels, and to be recruiting candidates and not just recruiting them, but like developing them, you know, just like you have a farm system in baseball. You have rookie league, A, double A, triple A. We should have that in the Democratic Party.
Well, I say that to people all the time. Like you should be paying attention to what's happening in your state legislature, because, you know, President Obama didn't walk off a cloud and become president.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the state senate, and he was a community organizer, and you know he you know, because people are so focused on national politics because it gets all the attention, it gets all the news, it's all, you know, it's much sexier, and like I think you said earlier that you're not as focused on that. I'm not either. I want a Democrat in the White House. I wish we had control of the Senate. I think it's better for everybody, but we're not going to ever get that if we keep losing ground on the state level. And we do keep losing ground on the state level.
We've lost, I think in the last decade or so, we've lost, I think it was like a couple thousand seats cumulatively over all the states in state legislatures. That's a disaster. You know, it's not just, it is important as a feeder, a farm system for the federal elections, presidential even, like Barack Obama, as you mentioned. But it's also important because a lot of important stuff happens at the state level.
Yes.
And even at the city level, and even at the city and county levels, a lot of important stuff happens. But at the state level, absolutely. From anything you care about, whether you care about a woman's right to choose or LGBT equality or immigration or energy policy or in the environment, any area, anything, it happens at the state levels. And because Congress is gridlocked, really the action's at the state levels in a lot of ways now. And Democrats have made a huge mistake. And I really hope that it sounds like the Clinton campaign might be onto this with their 50-state strategy or whatever. But we never should have dropped that, by the way. That was one good idea Dean had.
Dean had more than one good idea, let me just say. But
no, I didn't say he just had one.
That was your buddy Tim Kaine who ended the 50-state.
Yeah, my buddy. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if I'd characterize our relationship.
I'm kidding.
Yeah, no. That's pretty funny.
Tim, got time for one final question. Anything for Lowell?
Well, I did have to ask this. How's the governor and the legislature getting along right now, as if I didn't know?
Well, that's an interesting topic, too, and we don't have that much time, but I'll just say – I don't think the results indicate that they're getting along that great, but if you listen to Terry McAuliffe, of course, you know Terry McAuliffe probably.
Oh, yeah.
He's a talker. He's a sales guy. But anyway, according to him, they're getting along just great. You know, everything's fantastic. I don't see it in the legislation, like Medicaid expansion, for example, which is a huge priority, and we haven't gotten it. In fact, he didn't get most of his priorities. He had a bunch of things, including gun safety and gun control legislation and a whole bunch of different things. He didn't get any of it, basically. But they did get a budget passed. So he's touting it. I don't really understand why he's doing that, because to me, this is an election year in Virginia. Every single seat in the General Assembly is up. To me, you should be setting up the political argument and the policy argument. And the argument should be, you need Democrats, you guys need to turn out this year because we need to take back the state Senate and we need to pick up seats in the House so I can get stuff done as governor. You know, you worked really hard to elect me. Not, I'm getting along great with the Republicans. Everything's going fine. So then what's the argument? So then why should we turn out to vote and elect? I don't get that. Like, what am I missing here? Please. Fill me in. But I mean, I'm sure Terry McAuliffe's a far greater political mind. You notice the sarcasm here.
I don't know about that, but
no, you notice the sarcasm. Yeah. Sorry for the dripping sarcasm to end your show.
Well, no problem.
Well deserved in that case.
Yeah, I think in this case it is. It's kind of just too much to handle sometimes. Yeah. We're getting along great. You're right, dude.
Well, Lowell, I want to thank you again for being on the Kudzu Vine, informing us about Virginia politics. It took us to the end of the show, which was great. That was no problem at all. So we'll let you close out with us. Until next week, been the Kudzu Vine.
Good night, guys.
Good night, everybody. Thanks, Lowell.
All right, good night. Take care.
Good night.
We are the heirs of that.